This is a production of Cornell University.
All right, so as you all can see, watching us and the live or the video or listen to us on the podcast, we're joined by Dr. Cale Bigelow, professor and leader of the Turfgrass program, one of the leaders, I think the leader, certainly in the teaching area of the Purdue Turfgrass program. You don't have to tell everybody, Cale. I'm trying to make a big deal here. But I will say, as we get started, I'm starting to get worried now that dogs are starting to, you know, have to work a fair amount, and we're not really considering them as the labor force. And, you know, as you know, Carl, we started out with a skin machine and then a sand pro, now running robots, changing cups. It doesn't seem to be any end to what we'll get there. And since we're in a mood for a little bit of calamity, I will, if anybody is willing to take that code down and send money in, I'll be happy to send a picture of you with this, of me having a pie thrown in my face by my ag science students, which I know will do it with great love. I'll also, sort of entree into our conversation today, Carl, about, you know, what's going on this spring. And particularly the story is obviously wet. And we walked around the beautiful Lakeshore Golf and Yacht Club yesterday up along Lake Oneida with the walk and talk. And we saw a fair amount of this out there. So the spring is upon us. What's your thoughts about the growing season getting going?
Yeah, so one of the things we talked about yesterday, Frank, and we've seen some sort of chatter about it on various social media platforms, is golf course superintendents opening earlier, right? And this idea that the growing season is extending. And the NRCC folks, they've got some really good visuals of how this has changed over the years. So what people could see on the screen is the last spring frost date. So sort of an indication of, and I know for gardeners who are putting veggies in, stuff like that, you know, they got to get them in after that last frost in the spring. And you can see how this has sort of shifted earlier into the season. So that last spring frost is happening a little bit earlier. About 3 to 7 days earlier, depending on where you're looking there on the map. And then in the fall, when the first fall frost happens. So that sort of last frost in the spring to first frost in the fall is sort of that growing season we can think about. And in the fall, it seems to be extending even more than the spring. So 3 to 7 days earlier in the spring, 7 to 10 days later in the fall. And all this means is it's just a longer growing season. So more time that we're managing turf, whether it's golf course superintendents, sports field managers, or the landscapers getting out there earlier on the landscape. And actually for me as a golfer, the best way to think about when the season starts is, Frank, can I play golf? Can you just tell me when I can play golf? That's when the growing season starts. And we have data from the Pellucid folks who have an algorithm that calculates when is the weather that's conducive to golf. You know, 45 degrees, the forecast has to be good. There's got to be some light out there. And what we're finding is in New York and in the data we have, we're getting that this capacity for rounds, these days when you can play golf out there in January, in February, in December, even upstate here in New York. These are just three locations for folks watching. So it is indeed getting better, easier to play golf in the shoulders of the season. Ooh. The golfers want to go do it. Should I go prepare the golf course for the golfers? Maybe not. If you get stuck, like here's a picture of, full disclosure, this is me getting stuck a couple years ago on the Cornell golf course. I'm trying to get out there, getting data. Ooh, it's, you know, ready to go right into the mud. Right. And that goes hand in hand with some other things we're seeing, the percentage of rain we're getting relative to normal. All these northeastern states there, 140%, 200% of normal so far this year, in March. So we got our golfers wanting to play golf. It's warm, but we got a lot of moisture out there. It's wet. You know, should I open? Should I let golfers on my golf course? There's some cool traffic research out in Oregon State, right? Pacific Northwest is sort of right on the edge of being able to play golf most of those winter months. They decided to, hey, we're going to simulate traffic at different levels, 110, 220 rounds, 440 rounds per day on POA greens. And let's see what the turf quality looks like from January through March. What they found was, hey, even at 110 rounds per day, those POA greens hold up pretty good. Now, once you get to 220 rounds, it declines. Now, are you going to do 220 rounds in the winter? Probably not. So what this research says is, man, if I got POA greens, like it's okay if they go on the greens. I'm probably more worried about tees and like you showed, Frank, a cart traffic, maybe our maintenance workers, or if you got me running around in your golf course, maybe I shouldn't be out there in a cart. But With the putting green?
I gotta say, Carl, this is really important work. Because as climates change, right, and we have these longer golfing seasons, the thing about rounds per day is, and we've learned this, not everybody studies it the same way, right? Mm-hmm. And so you got to move the cup around, right, to be mm-hmm. able to tolerate this on a cumulative basis, right? You might have pinch points that if everybody's walking in the same spot all the time, it might only be 100 rounds a day or 50 rounds a day that could cause that problem. But I will say, Carl, before you move on, we also saw a fair amount of damage from the workers, right? The workers themselves getting out there doing that stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
And this is, from the athletics point of view, you've also got kids who want to get out there and play their sports early on, right? K through 12, you're playing sports in the fall and the spring. And that's when growth is low too, right? So it's 45 degrees. That's a great day if it's sunny to get out there and kick a soccer ball. But is the grass growing? Probably not. And this is what you see with community athletic fields. They get compacted early on, bare ground. What fills in? Probably crabgrass. That craps out early on, and you basically never have a safe or high-quality athletic field. We ran across this presentation from a California school district, Frank, that's got these really interesting numbers on field use. I don't know where these came from. I can't find any citations, but they said in their presentation they're looking at, should we have synthetic or natural grass? A perfectly maintained field can handle 10 hours per day of use. And not every hour for every sport is equal. If it's football, that's worth like 2 hours. If it's just, softball or baseball, that's worth an hour. But they're basically looking at, hey, if I have more than that use, even if it's perfectly maintained, I probably need synthetic and not natural. Now, let's take a look at that in March and April in New York, right? Can it withstand 2 hours a day, right? Probably not. And this is the argument for synthetic, especially up here where we have those wet conditions when it is warm enough to play, but not warm enough to grow, right? This is one of the solutions. And then maybe one of the other solutions, and this is where we bring in kale today, is maybe you select different varieties, right? And this is some research in the mid-2000s that you guys did with fertilizer timings and then also the turf varieties. And we've certainly seen this over the years, right? The Kentucky bluegrass, often selected on sports fields, but doesn't have that spring green up or the growth. Early in the season there, like a perennial ryegrass or a turf type tall fescue. And you can see there in the data, there's the yield rates over there on the far right-hand corner. And basically what you see is April and May, the yield, the amount the grass is gonna grow is much higher for perennial ryegrass or turf type tall fescue than Kentucky bluegrass. That means it's gonna handle the traffic better, right? At least in the springtime. So those are some of the maybe the solutions, synthetic tees, if you got golfers out there and you don't want to have divots, little mat, maybe that helps on the sports field side. If you don't have a synthetic sort of swing field to get people to, maybe you start thinking about these different varieties or fertilizing differently in the fall and maybe optimizing that timing. And there's some research on that as well.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, Carl, I had this slide. I'm going towards the end of what I was going to talk about before set Kale up, but Kale and Carl, since you brought it up, Kale, we were raised in the sort of turf grass world with this is how cool season grasses grow, right? And in this case, we're talking about sort of relative rate of vertical extension and relative rate of root growth or depth. So the deeper the roots, the more it's growing, the taller the pulse above, the more it's growing on the top. This is what we were taught. And to Carl's point about color and yield and green up, I don't know if this is actually the same study or not, but I used it in another presentation and kept the sort of thing on it. But this was, I think, some data that you generated as well, where you were collecting clippings. And again, you see tall fescue and even Kentucky bluegrass to be more of a, not a multiple pulse of growth, but rather sort of a most of it in the spring and almost, relatively speaking, you wouldn't call it a blip in the autumn. You'd call it more of a blip in the summer if you were saying growth was surging. So let's start here with this. Can we talk a little bit about what your observations have been over the years with tall fescue? Because I'll get to the weather and stuff in a minute, but Carl set you up really good here. You want to comment for a second about this work?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Carl. I think this definitely falls a little bit into that it depends bucket a bit too, right? And so that study that you highlighted, that was early in my career here, you know, so that's a good 20 years ago, and we were using improved tall fescues at that time, right? And as you well know, over the last 20 years, the advances on the tall fescues has been tremendous. One of the things I think that we saw was, you know, some of those earlier generations of the tall fescues was they still had some heritage towards their forage type friends, right? And so you had that spring pulse that was happening. But what I also think is important here is the fact that, you know, you had that growth flush in the spring, but it's also that sustaining of growth into the summer months, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of our newer tall fescues, and again, you know, the individual that recently graduated with me, Dr. Powlin, doing all her work on the brown patch and everything. I mean, there's some really good information there, but she's about to publish a study looking at, you know, leaf elongation rates and how that affects disease. So it's going to be some really interesting information that'll get into the literature, but those are these most recent generations of tall fescue. So I think that with, you know, what you're seeing on that big blip in the spring, that's probably going to come down a little bit as far as, you know, the growth rate. But the other thing you're seeing, and ultimately it comes down to those images you were showing as far as shoot density, right? And so these tall fescues or ryegrasses or whatever you're using, as long as you're maintaining the density, that's probably going to be a good part of this.
Okay. Interesting. And we're going to have you back to talk about, maybe we're going to get Jada to talk about
that. Yeah, you need to get Jada on here. She'd be happy to talk about that.
And the brown patch thing, because, you know, that's this thing about potentially regulating growth. I think people have said this from herbicides and maybe creating problems, having a tree barrier down, limiting growth rate. And I guess the use of whether PGRs do these things. I don't know how much PGRs we use. Tall fescue. Let me get back here to the weather, and I got some more. We got more tall fescue to talk about, Gail. Don't you worry about that. So the 2-inch soil temperature back 3 weeks ago now was barely creeping into the low upper 40s, low 50s. You had to get all the way down into Cal's old neck of the woods, down to Virginia Tech, where you were even making it to 60 degrees 3 weeks ago. But things haven't started to advance. And just last week, we were in the, you know, up, you know, mid 50s to mid 60s. And, you know, this week, we've seen a little bit of a sort of moving north still, but the temperatures are sort of holding. We're still in the mid 40s to the north and lows, the low 60s in the south. So it's almost feeling like we're a little bit further ahead next week. Last week, you got to watch the colors with these things. For those of you that use the forecast website, make sure you're looking at the colors, because sometimes they change depending on what you're looking at, whether it's depending on the scale below. So here is temperature departure 3 weeks ago, where we were cooler than normal. And then you really started to see a stall, that normal stall we see occur, especially along the coast relative to the 30-year normal. And now, most recently, it looks like it's been warm along the lakes and cooler along the Atlantic coast, but certainly a little bit above normal when you get into the Philly, you know, Maryland, Virginia, Delmarva area. It's consistently been wet. This was a few weeks ago, and now we're seeing it continue to be a little bit wet, but more wet to the west. And in fact, a lot of the western part of the region needed that moisture. We saw Thad Thompson yesterday came to the walk and talk from Buffalo, and he said, we were dry. We just got a bunch of rain, so we're good for now. Now, I'll just draw attention to one of the interesting tools Carl has built for the forecast website, looking at dandelion and clover flowering, this pollinator risk assessment tool, and it's projecting out to April 20th. And you can see that the pollinator risk is growing into central New Jersey and all the way into the metropolitan New York area, where dandelions are going to be beginning to flower. So you see that the green area is moving out, which means the risk is growing, right? Using the old growing degree day model for spring dandelion control that was developed years ago that we still use sort of as a marker, you see that where it's red in the pollinator risk assessment to the south, you see it green for weed control. So while we might recommend this, right, we want to be very careful about the way we manage these herbicide applications when the pollinator risk is a little bit higher. And that's just a really important point to consider when you're thinking about using these tools and making any applications to the lawn. Now, moving forward, looks like it's going to be, as Art told us this morning, a little bit of a carbon copy of the previous week, a little warmish and a little wettish, with sort of the 8 to 14 day bringing us around normal. So looks like we might get a little bit of a cool move through in the next few days, but otherwise looking pretty good. Now, the growing degree day differences are very interesting. And I think this is something that maybe we need to think about changing, Carl. This is collecting the growing degree days base 50 from March 15th. Right. So we usually start to think we can start collecting degree days then, but we may be accumulating some before then. Obviously, the spring with a very mild winter progresses fairly rapidly, but it still indicates we're behind last year's accumulation in that time period and at or near normal, except for the most northeastern areas that are well behind the 30-year normal, the Boston area, a lot of Massachusetts, a little bit in Dutchess and in Orange County. So phenological indicators, we've been staring at the forsythia already for a little bit, and we use this as a measure of determining crabgrass control, right? Whether we're going to put our pre-emergence down. And where kale is in southern Indiana, they're well along crabgrass germination there. We still are on the early phases of it, but I would say in the New York metropolitan area and south, now's the time to get that pre-emergent down. I think the pre-emergent model was telling you to put it out maybe even 2 weeks ago. I think we're at that point now where you probably should get your pre in the ground, but you want to watch out for all the water in the ground. I mean, we were talking to people this morning telling us, and I've showed pictures already, we've seen pictures, that you make a mess when you're getting out there trying to work this time of year. Now, Lee Miller, a new addition to the Purdue team over the last few years, Cale, now continues to send out this update. You can see, like I see, the National Phenology Network indicating that spring is really coming through very early, 20 days in some places. The forsythias are flowering and getting along. This was a picture I think I used last year. You take these lovely pictures roughly from the same spot every time. I don't know if you got a mark on it or something that you keep going back to roughly the same spot. This was last year, and it's been a little bit of up and down, right? And this is what I wanted to turn your attention to and ask you to speculate a little bit. We're having these fall spring, right? Where she warms up and gets going, and then you get that dump of snow. And we see this in the literature where we've, you know, adopted this name, fall spring. You get this extended warming, you get vulnerable plants. And it wasn't until Eric Watkins did some of this work with fall springs and the potential impact it can have on turf type tall fescues that I started to even think that this was problematic. So that same stuff that we were just talking about, Cale, let's start here. What are your thoughts about how the tall fescues have evolved away from that forage type? I wonder if it's making it more susceptible to this kind of stuff, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about the potential injury that these persistent fall springs might have. Obviously, it doesn't look like one day is too much problem, but, you know, 5 days of pretty nasty weather would looks like it would set the tall fescue back significantly.
Yeah, and, you know, an obvious question here, Frank, would be, you know, what was the maturity of these plants, right? And right. So, you know, is it the kind of thing that this was something that was seeded in September and then subject to this? Yeah. You know, we have, you know, historically here, the last several falls had that extended fall with a lot of warm temperatures all the way into November. And I think that there's some folks that are still trying to seed at that time of the year. By the same token, there's individuals that are seeding in September, but we've had that warmer fall and drier fall. And if you don't have irrigation and can't get that plant established, I could easily see this happening, certainly with the tall fescues. But
not mature stands.
not. I think the mature stands probably are not going to be as susceptible to what you see there on the far right. We haven't seen as much of that, but periodically we do. My program does a lot of cultivar and species evaluations, and we have seen some of this. We saw a little bit on some ryegrass too a couple years ago.
Okay. All right. So we're not necessarily, when we're mature, trading off this potential for damage. Because, you know, one of the reasons I think annual bluegrass dies in the springtime is, of course, it breaks dormancy and then the temperatures drop, hardening breaks down. And I'm just wondering if this is sort of a harbinger for things. But I know one of the things you've written about for the sod growers, particularly, and even the general public, about, hey, all fescue is maybe a good companion plant in certain plantings, pollinator plantings, but also really good for keeping weeds out. Once you get a good stand, they tend to be pretty good. I know you've talked about and visited this study that Doug's had going on out there in Wisconsin for a really long time. Doug sold that. Can you talk a little bit about sort of your feelings about, let's start with tall fescue as a sort of pretty good at keeping weeds out, even at relatively low fertility. And then we'll talk about how it's maybe good companion planting and pollinator things.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you start to think about these lower maintenance lawns, and, you know, I did have a chance to visit this site last summer and saw kind of what they have been doing for a number of years there at Wisconsin. I think that study's good 10 years old now, as far as these plots. Oh. And, you know, you could still see that stand of tall fescue that had been planted there, especially, you know, on the lower maintenance side with, you know, two fertilizer applications a year, you know, it was really holding stand density quite well. And, you know, I'm giving an exam in about 2 hours. And, you know, one of the questions there is, you know, how do you minimize, you know, the reliance on pesticides and lawns? And it comes back to cultivate a dense, healthy turf, right? And so choosing the right plant, the right place, and, you know, having tall fescue as part of our lawn, you know, blends or mixes seems to make a lot of sense. We've got a lot of evidence there.
Okay. So one of the knocks, I tried to get to the early spring thing. I'm trying to break down some of the pushback I get. How worried about, because you have much more intense brown patch pressure, you know, than we do, right? You're really in the transition zone for all intents and purposes. The line is getting further and further where you're included in it pretty significantly all the time now. I mean, I think maybe in the past, I don't know, but for sure, how do you deal with the potential brown patch susceptibility in the trials maybe that you've seen? Are we getting better? Is it superficial, or do we still got some work to do?
I think you got a couple of things there. So folks in that southern Indiana, the Ohio River Valley, that's definitely going to be, you know, prime time. That's probably almost as bad as a place like Raleigh where they're trying to grow some of the tall fescues. There are some nice granular products, you know, the ones that have the isoxystrobin, those are, you know, almost a gold standard as far as, you know, suppression of brown patch. It still comes back to timing of that fungicide, you know, so from the lawn care side, there are some granular products that are highly effective. But in addition to that, and again, I strongly encourage, you know, dragging Jada onto this show to have her talk about her stuff she did for her PhD, but you know, the range of susceptibility on the cultivars, I mean, there are some that are really highly resistant now. And so choosing those highly resistant cultivars, including them in a blend, or, you know, one of the other things that, you know, she and I've kicked around is can you interseed or overseed that superior cultivar into an existing turf to try and change some of the species dynamics? And I genuinely think that's a potential option for some of these lawn situations.
Okay, so a couple of things here. Thank you for bringing that up. You've obviously looked at this a little bit, right? And if we took all your work, which has been substantial now, not just with Jada, but other students have come and you've been evaluating these things for NTEP for years now. And one of the cells, when I got here to the Northeast 28 years ago, after being in the Midwest for a while, when I got back here to the Northeast, and I brought tall fescue with me because I'm like, man, these things look really good. Here we go. And by the way, it looks like it's going to get drier here in the summer. Now, it's not been very dry, actually, the last several years. But in general, I like the fact that if you gave tall fescue a halfway decent chance to put some roots down, it was going to root pound for pound deeper than just about everything else you could find. And that rooting is where the resilience lies. So let's talk a little bit, start with a couple of things. What would, do you like a turf type tall fescue sod that's 90-10 with the bluegrass there as a good solid approach to establishing, generally assuming you got the right place? Do you like that, or are you still okay with just put the sod and then interseed the tall fescue in?
You know, that's a really good question. And I've been talking to some of these developers recently, because I think in some situations, you know, some of these new communities, they're mandating sodding the front lawns, right? You know, this company comes in, they buy the land, they put in, you know, the three or four bedroom house, and you know, it's about having sort of the homeowners association do their thing. And unfortunately, a lot of times the sod growers locally, a lot of them just only have the Kentucky bluegrasses. But I think interseeding into that existing lawn is an option. It's actually more of an option than I had expected. But if some of these developers can interact with the sod growers and ask for some of these tall fescues as a sod, that's one way to go. I'd almost rather see you start with that.
Okay, so wait, now you're bringing up a better point, because it sounded like you were not hopeful that you were going to get much establishment from interseeding tall fescue in, because we get a lot of people come with the lawn from hell, right? I got to fix this thing. And I'm wondering if what you think is tall fescue is just good to stitch into any cool season grass lawn to maybe make it more resilient. But I worry a little bit about the clumpiness of that. Is that part of the reason you didn't think interseeding was going to be successful? And maybe it didn't get as clumpy as you thought. What do you think?
I think some of it mindset, you know, was going way back to even some of the work that you might have done and Dan Bowman had done, trying to interseed those bent grasses into putting greens, right? And trying to improve cultivars that way. And my mindset and frame of reference from that was that, you know, it's a numbers game, and the existing big bullies of grasses are going to crowd out any seedlings. But that's a different system, right? I mean, that putting green is a way different system than this lawn situation, especially if you're doing some fall seedings and those mowing intervals suddenly stretch from being, you know, 7 days to 14 days and giving those seedlings a potential opportunity to establish in there. But your point about the clumpiness, that is a possibility. I mean, that is a possibility. Especially if you're doing a 10,000 square foot lawn. But if you commit to a 2 or 3 year type of process, I think maybe that's less of an issue. A one and done, you're probably going to see some clumpiness, potential clumpiness.
All right, one more thing before we turn it over for questions. And that's the water issue that I've got up here. This tall fescue, I assume, will hold up longer with less water than a bluegrass will. But I've also learned that bluegrasses, don't sell them short. There's a lot of good bluegrasses that can still hold up. What is your feeling about, you know, because I see the bluegrasses improving, and we can leave the ProVista technology out for now, but I see the bluegrasses improving. I still wonder what your thoughts are. Is tall fescue pound for pound still a better manager of drought conditions than bluegrass?
Well, and it kind of comes back to consumer mindset. And so like this study, we had to kind of settle on something. And you know, you see there, we had 70%, you know, digital green colors, what we were working with as that point where, you know, the lawn owner is going to try and flip on the irrigation system or do something of that nature. If this is the right study, I think what was really cool about this was our bluegrasses, they were hitting that 70% green cover somewhere around 18 days. The tall fescues were closer to like 40, 42 days before, without any irrigation. They're hanging on, staying green for 40. That's over a month. That's crazy talk, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear you say, because we've seen this pretty consistently that if the consumer mindset says, I'm not worrying about this thing until it's 70%, you know, that's only 70% green. Yeah. That changes the game for us, because I think one of the problems is we've assumed everything's got to be dark blue green, completely weed free. And I think now the consumer mindset is changing. And What do you think, Carl? We're at the hour here. We're at our fastest 30 minutes went by in 32 minutes. So what do you like for a question or a comment before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think Vitas has a good question and speaks to sort of the application in sports turf field. So Frank, I know when you got here to Cornell, you thought, man, Talfescu, we should be using this for athletic fields. And people have concerns about its wear tolerance. Does it get thin and can it spread? So Vitas is asking, does it have any laterally spreading ability? Can it hold up there? Or do you need to intercede pretty frequently to sort of account for that wear tolerance?
It's for you, Cal.
Let me take that one.
Tell me if Talfescu has rhizomes.
Well, as we both know, and we've all seen the marketing information, is there are some that are weakly rhizomatous, right? And so they do spread out, and that's been documented that they do spread, but they're not as aggressive as, say, you know, one of these improved Kentucky bluegrasses that's used on some of these athletic field mixes. I mean, those are really aggressive, but they also are higher thatch formers too, right? Yeah. So, you know, you're trading things off sometimes. The other thing on the athletic field side with the Talfescu is where I think there's a little bit of market confusion is that you can't take them down in cutting height, right? We just actually published another paper, Jada and I published another paper looking at potential fairway grasses, right? And so one of the rock stars in that paper was we had some turf type Talfescu at a half an inch in our rainout shelter for multiple years. So this idea that maybe on, say, middle school or something like that, where they want to maintain a field at an inch and a half, I think our Talfescus are probably a reasonable or something in an athletic field mix. Talfescu bluegrass mix at an inch and a half, I bet you could do it pretty well.
Wow.
That's really fascinating because yep. I would worry a little bit about the canopy opening up. I can't wait. Is that already out? We got
it. Yeah, we published that about a year ago. I'll send it to you and Carl.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful. What else, Carl? We got to get him out of here. Cale,
we got one more from Rich.
So generous.
Yeah, and I remember, Cale, last time we had you on, we talked about the micro clover mixes. And Rich, I remember, sent me, Rich Bradley out in Cape Cod, sent me a mix. He had 90% turf type Talfescu and 10% clover. He said it got taken over by the clover like crazy. So he said the site's 50-50 sunshade. I remember asking him, hey, did you not fertilize it? He's like, oh, I fertilize it. So that's not the issue. Thinks he got too much water there, also got brown patch. Any thoughts on sort of what happened?
It could be all over the map, right? You know, and even when we've dealt with the micro clovers here, going back to that patchiness, Frank, I think with those people that are dealing with those clovers, there's the potential for that patchiness to develop in those systems. But the clovers, I think there's a lot we need to learn about the clovers, everything from pests, you know, disease and insect pests that could cause it to fail. But at the same time, the right conditions, like you said, sort of cooler and wetter, and that clover can just, it's a viney weed, so it could move.
Yeah.
Well, let's wrap it up there, Frank. We could go all over the place. It's funny.
Yeah, okay.
70% DGCI. Last year, we're measuring that out at our plots. I'm like, I like 60. Like, I don't mind 60.
Yeah, let's see? Yeah. There's the consumer. Anyway, thanks for joining us, Cale.
Awesome.
Yeah. Thanks, buddy.
Appreciate the time.
I'll make sure to put this on my annual report, engagement.
So. Happy day. Yeah, that's right.
Bye. See everybody next Thursday. See you guys.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.